You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere. Here are your hosts, Anthony Kestrovince and Phil Rogers.
Hello, this is Phil Rogers. Welcome to MLB.com Extras, NL Central Edition. We thought all year long we'd be talking about the Cardinals, but what we've been talking about is the Cardinals chasing the Brewers. Very solid Brewer team that finished the first half 10 games over 500 and then answered any questions by going 18-12 in their first 30 games in the second half. Pirates hanging in there. It's been a tough little stretch for the Reds, so maybe coming down to three teams we're talking about for the playoffs, although you'd probably be wrong counting the Reds out at this point, but they need to get going. We're going to be joined by Adam McKelvey, our fine Brewers beat writer, talking about a very solid Milwaukee team, 10 games over 500 and in first place at the All-Star break. I think some people were still waiting to see how they would do if they could hold together, and they come out and they go 18-12 in the first 30 games in the second half, and they've owned the L.A. Dodgers, a weekend sweep at Dodger Stadium. You don't do that very often after taking two out of three at Miller Park. Adam, how much fun do you think those Brewers have had playing the Dodgers lately? I mean, that's got to be huge for the confidence.
It is huge. I love that their catcher, Jonathan Lucroy, actually admitted that this was a big deal in saying after they finished the sweep that this is a potential postseason matchup. And if the Brewers get to where they want to go and the Dodgers get to where they want to go and those teams do see each other again, the Brewers should enter that matchup with a lot of confidence. Ron Renneke, the manager, didn't really want to have much of that. He was looking at the time they had 37 regular season games to go, and he pointed out rightly that those games are just as important and that they need to treat them as such and not act like they won anything by sweeping the Dodgers. But I mean, let's be honest. It's a big deal to face, in the span of 10 days, the best team in the league, record-wise, at the start of that span, the Dodgers, and you run into Zach Greinke and Clayton Kershaw four times in those six games, and you come away winning 5 of 6. There's no reason that the Brewers shouldn't feel pretty good about that. And at the end, if they get to where they want to go, I think we'll all look back at those games as a big turning point.
Well, and, you know, just if not that you need to throw anything extra onto that, but, you know, this is a Brewer team whose rotation has been battling a little bit of injury without Matt Garza for a while now. Kyle Loesch hurts his ankle, misses a start. But in that series at Dodger Stadium, with Jimmy Nelson, Yovani Gallardo, and Willie Peralta, 20 innings, only three runs. Do you think across the board baseball fans really realize how strong the Brewers rotation has been from the start of the year? To me, that's the biggest key for the Brewers has been that rotation.
And I agree with you. Mike Bauman, our fine columnist, did in the Brewers' last homestand a column on this same topic, arguing that they're not where they are without the rotation. That's a clear strength. I think the reason they don't get the love is they don't have the big-name guys. They don't have a Wainwright. They don't have a Clayton Kershaw. You know, they don't have an all-star, ace-type, no-hitter-type pitcher. But what they've got is five guys who are solid. Willie Peralta has been kind of jockeying for the big league lead in wins. You know, and I know we're not using wins to measure pitchers, but it shows you that he's pitched well enough to put the team in position to win a lot of games. Garza is the guy who sort of has the no-hit threat. You know, he's had a couple bids go deep into games, and he was pitching really well before he strained the oblique muscle. Kyle Loesch is just kind of steady and boring. He just gets through games, but he doesn't do it in a flashy way. And I think Yovani Gallardo has kind of developed into the same guy. He used to be more of a power strikeout pitcher. Now he'll strike out three guys in a game, but he'll get you to the seventh inning with a chance to win. So, you know, they're just not flashy. But they are getting a little bit more love lately because I think people are noticing the team a little bit more now. They haven't fallen off like I think a lot expected them to after they got off of that great start in April. And the players, the hitters, are starting to talk about the starting pitchers a lot more, you know, in terms of they're the reason the Brewers are in the spot they're in.
Well, as far as showing love goes, you can't go any further than I just did. I was taking a look at MVP candidates in the National League. It seems to me, you look at the American League, Mike Trout's a clear frontrunner. National League, I'm not really sure who it is. You have Giancarlo Stanton putting up the big numbers, but the Marlins, you know, are going to have to step on the gas to make the playoffs, and I think that's a big factor. And so when I'm looking at teams that can make the playoffs, I come up with your guy, Jonathan LaCroix, as a very, very strong MVP candidate. Matter of fact, I had him first right now going into the last 6 weeks of the season. Am I crazy?
No, I think I'm writing the same thing this week, and I actually asked him about it, and not surprisingly, he wants absolutely nothing to do with that conversation. He said literally all he cares about is winning a ring, and he could care less about the MVP race. But because it's a wide-open race, because he's been really good, and I think because he gets bonus points for being a catcher, the same way Yadier Molina has in the last couple of years when he's been in the debate, I think LaCroix is a strong candidate. You know, he's on a pace to break the record for doubles by a primary catcher, which is held by Pudge Rodriguez. That's a pretty good company to be in. And at the same time, he's still doing what he's doing defensively. He seems to be getting better defensively. He ranks among the highest, if not the highest, in pitch framing. He's getting better at calling games. He's just become a really, really good all-around player. And that MVP race is going to be really interesting in the National League. As you say, there's not anyone really running away with it. Some of the big guns have been hurt. So I think LaCroix is as strong a candidate as any right now.
Hey, I did not go this way, but I mentioned 10 different candidates, and I threw Carlos Gomez in there as a guy that would definitely receive some consideration to be somewhere on my 10-man ballot. But I overlooked Francisco Rodriguez. I mean, if you look at what he did stepping in for Jim Henderson, who, as a footnote, had his shoulder surgery this week, had the labrum cleaned up. Would you be wrong to talk about K-Rod as another guy that should maybe receive some MVP love in a wide-open race?
I mean, I think there's a possibility for some votes. I'd always go for an everyday player. I don't know where you fall on that, Phil, but I think the guys that are out there every day are, you know, just generally speaking, more valuable to what a team does. I think it has to be an absolutely extraordinary case for it to be a pitcher, which, you know what, in this case, Clayton Kershaw might be in that, he deserves to be in that conversation because the things he is doing are extraordinary. He's doing it for one of the best teams in the National League, and he's doing it in a year, like we've been talking about, where there's not a hitter that's clearly jumped to the front of the pack, that's doing something that's so remarkable that they're the shoo-in for MVP. So I think, I think get some votes, but those other players I'd rank ahead of them. Carlos Gomez had a really good case going. He's cooled lately, and it's led to all these questions of, does he need to start being more selective at the plate, take some pitches? Brewers don't think so. They think that he's gotten good when he turned him loose. He goes up there looking for a first pitch to hack, and he does it. And when he is that super aggressive guy, that's when he has his success. And they're not about to start to try to change him. He's just going to have to hit his way out of the kind of little mini funk he's been in the last few weeks.
I'm with you on pitchers, but I will, I would not vote for a pitcher for MVP, but I will slide him onto the ballot. Justin Verlander won just 3 years ago. So I know some of our voters will do it, but, it's got to be really an exceptional case, I think. One last thing, still sticking with the pitching side, Mike Fiers. Well, what a game he pitched against the Blue Jays. All year long I've been watching the Blue Jays just knock the ball around, and you think they come to Miller Park, similar to Rogers Center. They've got to be excited to get there. He gives up 2 hits in 7 innings against him. What is this guy doing so well now? It seems like a guy who's learned from some lumps he took earlier in his career.
Well, he's a guy who's deceptive, and a couple of comps. There's a pitcher, Josh Colemanter, in Arizona, similar overhand delivery, and then Chris Young of the Padres, and then the Mets, another guy who kind of went right over the top. And Fiers is that way, and the hitters just don't see the ball. And he's 88, 89, He can throw a fastball right down the middle and guys swing and miss at it. Stuff you don't see from any other pitcher, and it's because they just can't see it. So when Mike Fiers came up in 2012, the first time for the Brewers, he went on a really long run, and it was when teams hadn't seen or unfamiliar with that delivery and really struggled. When you saw him the second time around, then things started to swing back in the direction of the hitters. So the key for him now, if he stays in there, and we'll see what happens because Matt Garza is working his way back, but if he starts to see teams multiple times, the key for him is going to be, is his command better now than it was in 2012? And Ron Reneke has made the case that it is, that he's a better pitcher now than he was. But you're right, his success has been remarkable, and you know, he strikes out 14 against the Cubs a couple of starts ago. You look at the pitchers who struck out 14 this year, it's John Lester, Scherzer, Jose Fernandez, you know, it's guys that are some of the best pitchers in baseball, and then here's Mike Fiers, and he does it in six innings. And the list of 14 strikeouts in six innings, and you're talking about Nolan Ryan and Randy Johnson. So he's been a really fun guy to watch pitch and then sit at your computer and look up all the weird stats and all the weird historical comparisons he's drawing based on how well he's been doing.
Yeah, well, it will be fun to see if he can stay in there when those other guys get back. I don't know how you think the guy pitching that well and move him aside, but unless they go to a six-man rotation, something's going to have to give. So thanks
well,
so much for joining
us. Something will give, Phil. Phil, you've seen it enough where we're a couple of weeks away from Garza being back, and you worry about that now, and it makes no sense because he rolls an ankle next week, and then the decision becomes moot, and you know it's kind of made for you. So I think that's the way they're looking at it. They'll make the decision when they make it, and if he needs to leave the – I mean, Garza's coming back in the rotation. He's a $50 million guy. They want him to be – if they get to the postseason, he'll be key to that. And, you know, he's going to have to go, and it might be Mike Fiers. We'll see. For now, though, he's definitely making a little national name for himself.
Well, thanks a lot, Adam.
You know, one thing working in the Cardinals' favor, one note I saw was their 26 of their last 39 games are against teams with losing records. So, you know, that gives them a great opportunity to finish strong. And let's bring in Jennifer Langosch to talk about that. Jen, what's the sense of this team? Do they feel like, you know, maybe they're turning a corner offensively, or what's the general outlook there?
Yeah, I mean, I think you look at their last week, I mean, their last eight games and seven of them, they've scored four or more runs. And, you know, four runs might not seem like a high benchmark, but for this team, it had. Before this point, they had scored four or more in less than half of their games to this point. So, you know, the offense does seem to be coming to life a little bit. This is a good time for it to do so. I mean, obviously, the pitching has kind of continued to keep this team afloat, but, you know, they're in a stretch. You mentioned the games that they're going to play against teams below 500. They're also about to begin a stretch where they finished the season with 30 of 39 against NL Central teams. So, you know, in a division that is still a race, I don't know if you can call it a four-team race anymore at this point with the Reds fading and the Pirates also having a tough weekend. But that being said, the Cardinals certainly have an opportunity to pull up on the Brewers, maybe knock some of their other competition out of it entirely. And their offense, yeah, their offense has shown a little bit of life, and that's going to be the thing that gets them there or doesn't, is this inconsistently consistent offense that it's been all year.
Well, I know the moves they made at the trade deadline, certainly trading Alan Craig probably caught a lot of people by surprise. It struck me that no knock on Alan Craig, but this could be sort of an addition by subtraction and making it a little bit more clear to the lineup how Mike Matheny was going to be able to get Oscar Taveras and, you know, the younger hitters there worked in. How has that worked out, you think? Was there any sense of being able to get in a little bit more of a rhythm? I mean, you know, up until the last week, we really hadn't seen the production, but maybe it just took a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's been slow to come from Oscar. You know, they were in a situation, when you look at Alan Craig and Oscar Taveras in the month of July, where they were splitting playing time fairly evenly. Neither guy was able to get going, and the thought all along was, well, how is either one supposed to get going when they're not going to get consistent at bats? By trading away Alan Craig, that argument went out the window. The Cardinals had hoped that by Oscar being able to play every day, that he would get on some sort of role. He did hit in seven straight games immediately after the trade. Since then, though, it's been really slow to come. for the 22-year-old rookie. So, you know, did it clarify the lineup? Absolutely. I mean, our right field right now is Oscar's to play. Has it changed the production from the position? To this point, not so much. And, you know, and I know we've talked about this in earlier episodes, but we can certainly debate long-term what the loss of Alan Craig could mean and whether or not it could come back to hurt this team. But to this point, when you look at what they were able to get, being a John Lackey who has performed well in this rotation, I think the trade right now does make this team stronger. Again, though, this is a team that is among the worst in the majors in their production from right field, and that's certainly something that they hope is going to turn around in the last 6 weeks.
Jen, one area of interest for me with this club is the bullpen, and you know, a lot of young arms back there that carried them a long way last October, and that was really exciting to watch. But obviously, with youth and especially in the bullpen, there can be some erratic tendencies there, and the Cardinals have seen that this year. I think Kevin Seagrass was sent down to AAA this past week. They bring up Carlos Martinez, who's had his ups and downs this season, and Trevor Rosenthal in the closing role. His walk rate has gone up, his strikeout rate has gone down. In your eyes, what's kind of the state of the young relievers in general with this team? Is it something they're concerned about for the home stretch?
Yeah, it is. A lot of question marks there. I mean, you look at this team coming into the year, and the bullpen was an area that was really touted as very much a strength of this team. They came in with Kevin Seagrass and Carlos Martinez as setup guys, as you mentioned. Seagrass is now back in the minors. Martinez was just brought up because he had been sent down two, three weeks ago because of his command issues. So, you know, they haven't gotten what they thought they were going to get in the leanings from those two guys. You know, and Trevor Rosenthal, I think it's a big concern moving forward for this team. You know, Mike Mussini right now is adamant that Trevor Rosenthal is the closer. You know, if you want to look at the saves number, he has converted 36 of his 40 save opportunities. That being said, they are not clean. They are not efficient. And they are very, very, I think, somewhat worrisome for the Cardinals. I mean, right to this point, 40% of the first batters that Trevor Rosenthal has faced have reached, which is a high number for any pitcher, but increasingly concerning when it's your closer that's allowing that many walks, that many early hits in the inning. So they're going to stick with him to this point. I think workload and usage is going to become a concern. Again, this is a team that's played a lot of close games as a result of not having an offense that is blowing out other teams. And as a result, Mussini has overworked a number of the guys in the back end of the bullpen, with Trevor Rosenthal probably being chief among those. So when you look at the number of appearances that he's made, coupled with the number of pitches he's having to throw to get through some very laborious predicaments, it's a really volatile situation for a team that hopes to be playing deep into October. So I do get the indication that the Cardinals are going to try to pull back a little bit and be a little more liberal in giving him some rest, which you would assume then Pat Neshek would probably step in as a fill-in closer from day to day. But for right now, they're going to try to stick with Trevor. They hope to get Kevin Seagrass right again. We'll see what Martinez does when, you know, see what AAA was able to offer him and if he really has gotten back on track. But it is a team that is seeing a little bit that, you know, these young kids had a great flash of brilliance upon coming up, but it's not necessarily that easy going forward, and they faced that a lot this year.
Maybe a little bit of a bigger picture question, but when you look at what Mike Mussini was thrown into replacing Tony La Russa, and you know, big expectations, big results from the start, has this been a little bit of a different stretch? And by stretch, I guess I pretty much mean most of this season. I mean, it seems like things, you know, there have been no easy answers, and I just wonder how he has held up to that, you think, Jen?
Yeah, he's still figuring it out. You know, and I guess when you look at a manager's career, maybe that's the case all the way through to the very end of it. I think this year has exposed some things with Mike, again, because of the number of close games that this team has played. The way he has used his bullpen, the way he has overworked some of these young pitchers has really come under fire recently. You know, the lack of offense, the lack of production with runners in scoring position, which is in great contrast to what they were last year, has come under fire a little bit. You know, Mike Mussini kind of, and his hitting coach being the center of that. So, you know, it is a learning curve for him. You know, all along, his strength, and it was touted when he was hired for this position, was his ability to have a cohesive and create a clubhouse that's cohesive, an environment that, you know, is willing to work with young players and kind of invite them into this clubhouse and have a comfortable environment. To that extent, things have been very good, and they've kind of been the same as the last 3 years. On the field, though, you know, he is, we watch it every day. There is a learning curve with him in terms of how he uses his pitchers, how he uses his bench. The double switching can get frustrating for people that watch from time to time. So he's learning it, you know, and for an organization that had a guy in Tony La Russa who was, you know, a tactician to the nth degree, you know, I think it has been a little bit different watching Mike work with this club, and it has been a frustrating team because of the expectations, not just that everybody else had on this team coming into the season, but certainly that they had internally and have been far from reaching to this point.
Hey, Jen, on a different note, on a lighter note, you were there last weekend when the Cardinals held their first induction ceremony for the Cardinals Hall of Fame, and Marty Marion, Mike Shannon, Jim Edmonds, and I'm sure the loudest cheers probably went for Willie McGee. We know how much St. Louis fans love them some Willie McGee, but what was that experience like for you, you know, watching that all unfold and watching the fan reaction to that?
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, the Cardinals have such a storied history and tradition. It's kind of a shame that it's taken this long for them to create a Hall of Fame. So much overdue getting that established up over at Ballpark Village across from the ballpark. But great ceremony. Willie McGee is beloved in the city. And, you know, there's been a lot of people for a lot of years calling for the organization to retire his number. And, you know, that hasn't been done to this point because he's not been inducted to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. But this kind of takes that place, you know. And I think the thing that was really special to those guys at the ceremony was they were given the red jackets, which, you know, for those of us in St. Louis, we see the Hall of Famers, the National Baseball Hall of Famers, parade around every opening day, every postseason in their red jackets. And it's a really meaningful gift from the organization. Well, moving forward, the players that are also voted into the Cardinals Hall of Fame are also given those red jackets. So, you know, a symbol of what these players represented to this organization. It was great to see the highlights, you know, the Jim Edmonds big home runs in the NLCS, huge catches. Willie McGee, seeing the highlights of him running the bases again, winning a World Series as a rookie. Mike Shannon, a staple in the city for over 50 years. And then Marty Marion, whose family was able to be there on his behalf. Really a special day in St. Louis, a great turnout from the fans, and something I look forward to seeing now annually moving forward.
Well, that's great, Jen. Thanks very much for joining us. Let's bring in Tom Singer, Pirates beat writer. Tom, what's your outlook for Andrew McCutchen as he barring anything unexpected, looks like he's getting ready to come back off the disabled list?
Yes, he is. He's eligible to come back on the 19th, is eligible. He's doing everything in workouts, live BP, the machine revved up to a high speed, breaking pitches, running the bases, you know, making those left turns, throwing in the outfield. The difficult thing with McCutchen is it's such a rare injury. There's really no case study, and it's a very easy injury to re-aggravate. So when they time his return, they have to be pretty comfortable that he's past that point. And he himself doesn't have the possibility of re-aggravation in the back of his mind. You know, Hurdle loves McCutchen for being a very honest self-evaluator, so he will not come back until they reach that point, until he feels that he's reached that point. And you're absolutely right. Even though they've kind of treaded water without him, Travis Snyder, big contribution to make up for McCutchen's bat. Getting him back will definitely give not only a performance jolt, but a psychological jolt to this team, and maybe at the right time.
Tom, what we mentioned Neil Walker earlier, you know, missing a lot of time lately with the back. What's the full extent of that injury? And I'm sure he's still going to be playing through some things, you know, in the home stretch. How much does that obviously, I'm sure it impacts him a great deal. What's sort of the outlook for him going forward?
Well, they've already gone through the trials of him re-aggravating his lower back tightness. So before he returned again, they made sure everything was quieted down back there. He himself pronounced himself as good as he's ever felt. The back has totally quieted down. When he came back the second time, he's going to play about three games in a row, then take a day off. But it's really precautionary to make sure that the back does stay silent, because essentially they're plan is to make sure that he can take the field every day in September down the stretch. So they want to get him to the point where you know, any recurrence of these back spasms is not likely. I mean, you can never rule it out, but you can certainly stack the odds against it. So they're being very careful with him, because, like I said, they've already gone through the re-aggravation thing with him. which, you know, they want to avoid with McCutcheon. It's totally different injuries, but obviously you bring somebody back too soon from a very nebulous injury, and then you can re-aggravate it. So, I mean, they kind of, you know, that's actually, that's what they did with Gerrit Cole as well. When they brought him back the first time, he was on the DL with a tired shoulder. He lasted two starts and came down with a different injury. And this second time, they've really taken their time with Gerrit until, you know, they're absolutely assured that he's ready to step in there and take the ball every 5 days going down the stretch.
Hey, Tom, props to you, because you told us a month ago that, they wouldn't really look to Gregory Polanco to be the guy to lead them, that you know, they felt like they would welcome what they'd get from him, but they didn't expect for him to come in and be a savior. And you mentioned Travis Snyder, but what about what they've been getting in August from Starling Marte? It seems like he's really picked up his game at the right time and is having maybe as good of a month as he's had. Not necessarily hitting a lot of home runs, but extra base hits, using his all around tools. How important is he been?
Well, absolutely. You know, Travis has been the extra bat in the lineup, but Marte is the one who's taken over in center field, which is his original position. I think he's gotten himself a spark out of playing his old position. He likes being in the middle of the outfield. He likes the added responsibility, and he's come through. And he's also been batting deeper in the lineup. A couple of days ago, he batted cleanup for the first time and produced. So, you know, oddly enough, when McCutcheon does come back, I mean, there's no way that can be a negative. But in a sense, he'll take the spotlight off Marte, which he has really enjoyed and has, you know, flourished under. But they're absolutely delighted with how he's performed since he came back from about 10 days on the concussion list.
Tom, I know, you know, with everything Pedro Alvarez is going through mentally over third base, there were plans to work him in at first. But, you know, those plans kind of changed with just the alignment of the health situation. Jordy Mercer beat up at short, so, you know, that impacted Hurdle's ability to move Alvarez around. But just looking forward here, going forward, is that still an option on the table? Is that something we expect to see with regularity, Alvarez at first base, or do you think he's going to remain a mainstay at third?
Well, no, it's definitely an option. It's such a very odd situation. He was geared up to play first base in the series in Washington, but as you said, Mercer went out, so Harrison had to move over to a shortstop, and Pedro got his old position back. But unfortunately, he also had his old problems come back. He made a wild throw in one game that cost him a very critical run. So I think that, you know, once Mercer comes back, if the opportunity again presents itself, they would like to try Alvarez at first base. I mean, it's not an easy position. I think, you know, like Arizona, where Mark Trumbull had to go over to first base when Paul Goldschmidt went out. And I've heard all kinds of nightmares about how difficult a time he's had handling that position. So when Pedro does go to first, it's not a permanent position switch, but they do want to see what he can do there. And it's a really, really strange dynamic that he had to go back to third base. I mean, they did not plan on that at all.
Tom, last thing for me, obviously the bullpen has been an area of concern. Saw blown saves in back-to-back games at Washington last weekend, and you know, a little bit of a change in cast out there, but they did make a nice addition in picking up John Axford. And I'm wondering if it could be a case where his role, you know, he grows into a bigger role than maybe people thought, and getting a kind of a fresh lift when they need one.
I would think it's a definite possibility. Their backup closer, with Jason Grilley gone, obviously, has been Tony Watson. But Tony has had some tough outings in his setup role as well as in the eighth inning. Axford has only pitched twice, has looked well. I believe he pitched the ninth inning or the eighth inning. Anyway, he's been in some high leverage situations, and he's done well. So I would think he's at least moved into the situation of being the number one backup to Mark Melancon if Melancon has any difficulties. The difficult thing with the Melancon's blown save on Sunday, it was the first time he pitched in almost a week. So not only the typical rhythm that pitchers always talk about, but I would think the mental edge that a closer needs. If you don't have the opportunity to do that for a whole week, I would think it has to dull the mental edge and you just don't feel right. If Melanson gets consistent work, which obviously would mean that offense comes around and they have more late game leads than they have lately, I still think he'll be okay. But, a couple more stumbles, I do think we can see John Axwood in the ninth inning, yes.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. And the Pirates have had a lot of ups and downs here these last few weeks especially, but still so much of the season still right in front of them. Starting Friday, they'll have a stretch of 12 straight games against the Brewers, Cardinals, and Reds. So, obviously, those are three teams they need to take care of business against. But I want to thank Tom Singer for joining us.
Going to be joined by Mark Sheldon, excellent Cincinnati Reds writer. He'd like to report currently he's doing a little bit better than his team has been doing lately. It's been a very, very rough stretch for Brian Price and his team, falling a little bit out of touch in the National League wild card race, needs to get hot in a hurry to get back in it. Mark, welcome aboard. How you doing today?
Doing fantastic. Like you said, doing better than the team's doing, but right now it's been a struggle for the Red Legs.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we talk about you want to see players when they're going good, when they're going bad. Same thing with teams. How have you seen that Brian Price, rookie manager, and the team kind of handling this situation?
You can definitely tell it's wearing on them. I think the last time I talked to Anthony, I kind of made a comment that one of the things that Brian had done really well is not let the hard losses spill over to the days afterwards, and in a sense that way it kept it from spilling over to the team. And you could definitely tell after the double heartbreak in Colorado on Sunday going into Monday, he was still wearing it a little bit. And then, of course, that compounds into what happened on Tuesday with a heartbreaking loss at the hands of J.J. Hoover and hitting a batter with the bases loaded. And just these defeats keep compounding, and they keep sort of being painted into a corner where they really can't do anything about it because they have, a gassed bullpen. The starters aren't going deep enough, and they're not able to hold leads in the late inning.
Well, J.J. Hoover tied a club record with his 10th loss in relief, but I think the most alarming sight must have been Aroldis Chapman just completely losing track of the strike zone. Just a blip on the radar. How do you assess Chapman going forward from that debacle?
Well, it's going to be interesting because I think the debacle may have been injury-related. They didn't know about it until it was too late on Sunday, but he hasn't pitched the last 2 days because of what they're calling an achy shoulder. Now, they're not saying it's serious enough, and they're always saying he's available unless he's on the disabled list, is what Brian Price's words were. But clearly, he wasn't available last night, or they would have used him, or they would have brought Broxton in instead of Hoover maybe for the ninth. And held on to Chapman for a safe situation, and they obviously don't have him, and then that's compounding the issue. But assuming he's healthy, I really don't think that's what happened in Colorado is going to be indicative of what he's going to bring the rest of the year. He's been one of their best pitchers. He's had great velocity, had great command, and he's had three pitches. And I think, assuming there's nothing physically wrong with him, he should be fine going forward.
Well, one guy who seems to have kind of got turned around in the midst of this rough stretch for the Reds, Jay Bruce. What anything to point to for how he's kind of back to being the Jay Bruce people have been used to seeing?
Well, he's been strong the last couple of days. I think it's too early to say whether he's found it or caught it. One of the things about Jay, and you talk to him, whether he's going bad or going good, is that he's very approach-driven, and he wants to have the same approach in the same mindset going into all his games and at-bats. And he feels like if he can at least do that properly and have the right mental approach, that the results will come. And sometimes they don't, but he's always been pretty confident in what he's done the last couple of years. But there is no doubt and he's already admitted it, this is the worst year of his career offensively, and he's having a real struggle. But the last couple of nights have been encouraging, and I think they would love to see more of that. They wish they would have had that when both Votto and Bruce were out together, or Votto and Phillips, excuse me, they could have had him pick it up. But right now they're obviously happy to get some offense. They've been kind of up and down offensively, and if Bruce can kind of put it together, maybe some of the other guys can too.
Brandon Phillips off the disabled list. Where would you say see him fitting in for potentially trying to, he's the guy that when this team was going good, he's always right in the middle of it. And is it fair to look for him to jump in during the middle of an injury plagued year and come back and be his old self?
I don't think they're expecting him to be his old self. They're batting him further down the order. He hasn't honestly looked particularly good in his first two games back at the plate. He's got one hit, but I think they realize he's not 100%. They know that maybe he's as close as he can get till the off season comes and he can really rest up and heal. But they really don't know what to expect. I asked Price that and about what can you expect from a guy? You guys need a lot of offense. And I think, Phillips, before he even got hurt, wasn't having his most robust offensive season. He had a 700 OPS. It wasn't like, they have so many problems right now. Just expecting him to show up and hit is probably overreaching a little bit, that he could somehow save the day. But certainly he can't hurt. And if he can get comfortable with the plate and get in a groove, if Jay Bruce stays in a groove, if Devin Mesoraco can get out of the slump he's in, maybe they can try to turn things around.
What about those St. Louis numbers? Dropping the first two games of the series this week there. Now their last 21 series, going back to August of 06, they've only won one of those last 21 series. Is it has it become a big mental block? And, can you just sense the Reds hate it when they get to St. Louis?
I've never sensed that. They've never been afraid of the Cardinals, so to speak. But you got to wonder, especially during the Dusty and Tony years, whether the Cardinals were in the Reds' heads at times. The Reds had some nice series against the Cardinals, and especially in 2010 when they were the division winners and they kind of, took over the throne for a little while. And the Reds seemed to play these August series really tough and do really well, even if it was, here or in Cincinnati. But now they've lost, I think, 11 of the last 12 series in both cities, going back about 2-3 years. And it's just the Cardinals just seem to do it all. And when the Reds, especially offensively, they don't ever get those big two-out hits when they need them, and the Cardinals do. And guys like Matt Adams, who's hitting like well over 400 against the Reds since he's been up here, the Reds just don't have anyone to answer on their side offensively.
Last one, Mark. When you look back at this tough stretch, a ton of one-run losses and a bullpen that is just kind of unraveled as we speak, the last four games, 26 hits, 12 walks in 10 and two-thirds innings. And, obviously getting the bullpen turned around has got to be job number one for the Reds at this point. What would you point to for hope? How can they get that reliable relief pitching they haven't had?
Quite frankly, it's going to be on the starters. Other than Johnny Cueto, he has half of the Reds' wins since the All-Star break. He's got 5 wins. The team has 10 wins, I think, total. I think they're 10-29 since the break or something like that. And, Homer Bailey's hurt. Alfredo Simon isn't anything close to what he was in the first half. He's only had one start in the second half that's gone more than 6 innings. You have, Mike Leake hasn't been pitching as well as he has been, and so on. And starters that are only going 5 innings and coming out, asking the bullpen to throw, fill in the last 4 innings plus any extra innings that come up, is a recipe for disaster. And especially when guys like Chapman aren't available, or if somebody's been pitching 3 days in a row, like Jumbo Diaz did on Tuesday night, these things are going to catch up. And what they really need is just a stretch through the rotation where everybody goes 7 innings, and they only have to come up with 2 innings to close the game. And right now, they just don't have that guy other than Cueto that's been doing that consistently.
Well, we'll keep our eye on it. Obviously, it's a lot better team than they've been playing lately, and some better starting pitching, big relief outing here or there, and maybe they can get turned around. Mark, thanks very much for joining us. Going to bring in Kerry Muscat, MLB.com beat reporter. When you look at this Cubs pitching staff, there were a lot of double-figure games by the opponents in the first couple weeks after that the Marzia trade, and even early in the second half, Arizona had a big game against them. The Padres had a big game against them. But now looking at it, you know, it seems like the Cubs have kind of got their pitching feet back under them, and jobs from Kyle Hendricks has been obviously very, very valuable. But even Shiosi Wada seems to be giving them some really good work. Is there anything you can point to just kind of for getting the pitching staff turned back around? And this is a team that had good pitching early in the season, and it's come back again.
Well, obviously, one of the reasons the pitching was good early was because of Samardzija and Hamels, who of course are gone. I give credit to, I think Hendricks is pitching the way a lot of people had hoped he would. The kid has shown absolutely no fear. He's incredibly well prepared, and he's posted, I believe now, 6 quality starts, and had a great game in New York that really impressed not only the Cubs but also the Mets. Wada is—he's 33, so he's got some experience, and it's just really taken him some time to sort of get into a groove here. I think one of the neat things about Wada is that they've been matching him up with catcher John Baker, and what Wada has told Baker is, "You put down the signs, I'll throw what you want," and he's put total trust in Baker, and Baker did his homework, I think. He talked to Eli Whiteside, who had caught Wada at Triple A Iowa, and asked him, you know, what worked, what didn't work, what do I do to get him back on track? And Whiteside gave him this really long text and explained everything. And if the Cubs can somehow try and keep matching up Wada and Baker, I think that'll work out well. And then Jake Arrieta's been pitching the way they had hoped. He's put together some good outings. He had an incredible curveball during their Cubs series in New York that surprised him, and that was good to see. Good to see him able to come up with something else on his repertoire. So there's some good signs. They're giving these kids a chance, and they're going with it. Although I include Wada as a kid, but they're giving them a chance.
Yeah, Arrieta, they had to feel good. He had a really tough start at Coors Field, which, of course, a lot of pitchers will have tough starts at Coors Field, and then now has bounced back with good outings against the Brewers and the Mets since then. I don't know that we spent a lot of time talking about the backup catchers, but if you talk about the Cubs, John Baker seems to just jump into the conversation a lot of places with things he's done or his influence. Could he wind up being a guy that kind of, by doing a little bit of everything this year and doing it with such a good attitude and letting his experience work for other guys, be a guy that kind of carves out a spot for himself that, could carry over into 2015 and beyond? Is this a guy that could be make a role for himself in this rebuild?
Well, I know they need, one of the things that Theo and Judd have talked about a lot is how, okay, yeah, we have all these kids, but we do need some veterans there to sort of, not necessarily act as mentors, but just kind of offer some help. Carlos Villanueva does it down in the bullpen. You've got, they have Justin Ruggiano in terms of the position players. But Baker influences a lot of the guys. He keeps them happy. He deals with a lot of the pressures well. If he could hit a little better than 195, I think that they'd like to see that. But I'm not sure you can fix that. Obviously, backup catchers, their most important job is to be a backup catcher, and to fill in that way. What I liked is when we were in New York, and Junior Lake was sent down, Baker was like one of the first guys right by Lake's side to try and pick his spirits up and got him to smile and joke with him and, said, in 15 days you better be back or I'm going to come and get you kind of thing. So to make Lake feel a little better about his demotion. I mean, Baker's, the only thing that I've heard any complaints about is Baker's taste in music, but I think some of the guys are sort of getting used to it now.
Yeah, absolutely. If that's the worst thing you got going for you, that's all right. Javier Baez has been up a while. It seems like
delivering almost exactly what people would have thought. But I'm wondering, you know, we see the home runs, we see the strikeouts. That's pretty much what everybody expected. But in terms of his play at second base and work as a double play partner, what have you kind of seen from him on a daily basis, his work in the field?
Actually, I think he's been better at second base than maybe some people had projected. He's handled the transition very smoothly. And Castro, I know, has been there to help him every step of the way. And they turned a really nice double play. Again, I hate to keep going back to the New York trip, but they turned a really nice double play in New York that Baez was in the right place, right time. He could, you know, if Javier keeps working at it, he can easily be a really terrific second baseman there. I haven't seen any glitches at all so far. His range is pretty good.
Well, and going back to that New York series again, it seemed like for all the reporters there, especially the media covering the Mets, shortstop's been such a hot-button issue for the Mets for so long. And they look over and they see Starlin Castro and the Cubs' core of kids shortstops. They have pitching to trade. Just looks kind of like to be a natural. And I was just kind of impressed by how Starlin Castro handled the questions about it and talked about, no, I want to stay with the Cubs my whole career. How much of a distraction kind of is this talk about potential trade down the line and the fact that ultimately they're going to have to sort out the surplus of shortstops?
Yeah, I don't think it's a distraction. I think it caught Starlin off guard in New York, because as he told us after the New York writers had left, he said, well, you know, it's after the trade deadline. Why are they bringing this up? He didn't, and there's no way they're going to put Castro through waivers, as we know. So it just, you know, the Mets need a shortstop. Yes, the Cubs seem to have a lot of them, but again, they're not ready to part with Starlin. Starlin, I don't think really. I think he was just really flummoxed by the questions. Just didn't expect them, and I was surprised. You know, the Mets writers were saying there were going to be signs and everything, and people cheering him on. I didn't see that. I did see that Castro really had a really good series, though, and he's really had a really good season overall. So if the Cubs do, I don't think the Cubs, personally, I don't think the Cubs would trade him, even though they do have a lot of shortstops, because, A, they don't know, who knows how Addison Russell's going to develop. You know, he's at Double-A. I think they need to wait and see there. I think they're going to hang on to these kids as long as they can and see if they can find places for all of them for right now.
Well, and you've got, Castro back on track, having an all-star season. You know, obviously a lot of value, maybe just kind of pushing the story ahead to the winter meetings. And, you know, I think what you see or hear with Theo Epstein is, you know, they're no untouchables, doesn't rule out anything, so you do wind up with a lot of conversation that's probably going to continue. But like most trade stories, I'm with you. It doesn't mean they're going to trade him. And the contract he has, I think, gives him a ton of value for the Cubs going forward. Well, Kerry, thanks very much for joining us. This has been MLB.com Extras, NL Central Edition. For Anthony Kasserbintz, this is Phil Rogers saying thanks for listening.